Hi, I'm Eden.
And I'm Nicole.
And welcome to
Roadside Horror Show.
Join us on a road trip down the dark and winding roads of America, where we'll take turns exploring the strangest true crime and paranormal stories we can find.
We'll devote two episodes to each state we stop in, sharing a true crime and paranormal story each week.
So buckle up as we head to this week's destination, New Jersey.
Also known as the Garden State, New Jersey is one of the original 13 colonies and is the most densely populated state in America, despite being the fourth smallest by area.
With its diverse population and long history, New Jersey is home to some of the strangest stories in the United States.
So Eden, what's your unusual story for today?
Well, today I'll be taking you to New Brunswick, New Jersey, a town in Middlesex County, which is in the New York City metropolitan area. Downtown New Brunswick looks like a big city and even has some skyscrapers, but this crime happened way before any of those were built. So let me take you back to the 1920s.
Yeah, the roaring 20s.
Absolutely. For the Hall Mills murder.
I'm excited.
It's a really cool story, and I'm surprised that I had never heard of it before researching it. It's also known as the Minister and the Choir Singer murder. And although this is a case that a lot of people don't even know about, it was a huge media sensation in the 20s. So Edward Wheeler Hall was born on June 12, 1881. He was raised in Brooklyn, got his theology degree in Manhattan, and became a minister, as the secondary name of our story would suggest. He married his wife, Frances Knoll Stevens, on July 20, 1911. Frances was 7 years older than Edward and very well off, so most people believe that he married her for her money. And judging by the picture I saw of her, she's not a very attractive lady, so I'm sure he didn't marry her for her looks. Let's just say that.
I mean, fashion was different back then. But
that's true, but this is... I'll show you later. He later started working at St. John the Evangelist Episcopal Church and moved to New Brunswick, New Jersey. Well, that was probably not the best idea for Hall and his family, seeing as this place would be where he got murdered. On the morning of September 16th, 1922, Raymond Schneider, who was 23, and his girlfriend, Pearl Balmer, who was only 15, kind of gross, were taking a pleasant stroll through a dirt road in New Brunswick, a road that at this time was like a lover's lane.
Okay.
And it was near a farm. Sadly, their plans for a nice fall stroll in their Ugg boots with their pumpkin spice lattes, followed by a little jailbait action, didn't quite pan out. So, instead, they happen upon a man and woman lying on their backs under a tree. The man was dressed in a gray suit with a white shirt. His hat had been placed over his face. His female companion lay with her legs crossed, her head resting on the man's outstretched arm, and she wore a polka dot dress with a brown scarf. So no Ugg boots yet, but you know.
It's coming.
The couple immediately could tell that the two of them were dead. So the couple ran to the nearest house and had the owner call the police. When the police arrived on the scene, they were able to identify the bodies due to the man's business card, which was propped up against his shoe. And the man, of course, was none other than Edward Wheeler Hall.
It's so, like, weirdly specific.
It is very strange. Someone wanted
them to know. Posed and, like, very interesting. I'm intrigued to see where the story goes.
The woman beside him wasn't his wife, Frances, but Eleanor Mills, a woman who sang in the church's choir and was married to James Mills, the church's sexton. I looked it up because I had no idea what the word meant. And for those of you who also don't know, a sexton is, according to Google, a person who looks after a church and the churchyard, sometimes acting as a bell ringer and formerly as a grave digger.
Oh.
So he did all that nice stuff for the church. The police then came to the conclusion that the two were having an affair. How, you ask? Well, I'll tell you. Along with the bodies, they found a bunch of love letters they had written to each other scattered throughout the field near the bodies.
Ooh.
Yep, it's very juicy. Like I said, this was a media circus at the time.
I can totally understand why.
Yep. Mills had written such saucy notes as, Sweetheart, my true heart. I know there are girls with more shapely bodies, but I am not caring for what they have. I have the greatest part of all blessings, a noble man's deep, true, eternal love. How impatient I am and will be. I want to look up into your dear face for hours as you touch my body close.
That is pretty saucy for the 1920s.
That is very saucy. Oh, but it gets better. Hall's note said, Darling Wonderheart. First of all, what? Anyway, I just want to crush you for 2 hours. I want to see you Friday night alone by our road, where we can let out, unrestrained, that universe of joy and happiness we call ours.
So it's like her version of a booty call letter?
It's a guess. That's what they did in the 20s, man. So that's interesting. I mean, Darling Wonderheart.
Darling Wonderheart.
I'm just going to start calling everyone that.
I feel like I've seen that band.
That would be a good band name. I like it. Just like that article that I saw the one time when I said I was going to make my next band after it. It said, China Ferrari Sex Orgy Death Crash.
That's a good album.
I'm like, yeah, there we go. Perfect. So maybe this is just how people talked in the 20s, but I seriously doubt it. That's just weird. Apparently, he signed the notes DTL. Not DTF.
I love that you saw my look.
No, I was thinking it too. It's okay. But he signed the notes DTL, which stands for, this is German, so if I say it wrong, you know. Daniel, now I'm just sounding French. Tu es Liebhaber.
What?
Yeah. It's German for thy true lover. And, oh, she also referred to him as Babykins, by the way.
Babykins, that's what I call my cat.
So, oh god, I even wrote my notes here. DTL? I think it was more DTF. But we got there before my notes did. The autopsies showed they were both shot and killed with a .32 caliber automatic pistol. Here's where it gets rather gruesome, so sorry guys, but this is going to get gross. Edward Wheeler Hall had been shot near his right temple, and it came out the back of his head on the left side, while Eleanor Mills had been shot 3 times in the head, with one of the bullets entering right above her nose, another through her cheek, and one through her temple. And prepare yourself for this, and cover your ears if you're squeamish, but her throat had also been slit incredibly deep, and, quote, her jugular vein, windpipe, esophagus, and neck muscles were completely severed, and her backbone could easily be seen.
Mm.
That's a lot of rage.
Yeah, especially towards her, and surprisingly little.
Toward him, mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly, which is why I come to a different conclusion than the people did, but I'll tell you about that at the end. So, as you can imagine, between the way the bodies had been found and the gory details, the love notes, the affair, this was a really big deal and got crazy amounts of media coverage, which led to the farm they were found by to become a mecca for the really macabre, crazy people.
So it kind of became one of those, like death, celebrity death sites, sort of?
Pretty much. People would actually go there and hunt for souvenirs. The crab apple tree that they were found under was stripped of the branches and even some bark, and there was even a guy who sold bags of dirt from the nearby tree for 25 cents a bag.
Ugh, people buy anything.
Not a bad way to make a living, I guess, if you have no conscience.
I guess.
Obviously, this made it tough for police to do their job and gather evidence, and the investigation dragged on for 2 months. And they still didn't know who the killer was. They mostly suspected the pastor's wife and her 2 brothers. I personally don't know why they didn't go for Eleanor's husband.
Yeah, isn't it always like the husband?
Because she was the one that was most brutalized. And I wouldn't be so mad at the person they cheated on me with. I'd be mad at the person who cheated on me. Right. You know what I mean?
Because that's where the betrayal is.
Exactly. Like,
and that's where your anger's based.
Yeah. Because, I mean, yeah, I wouldn't like him very much either, but I'd be more...
agitated at your partner.
Yes. So it seemed like, yeah, like the person was even more angry at her than the pastors. And I know, like I said, I'd be more pissed off at my partner. So finally, a jury convened, and after 5 days, no charges were brought against Hall's wife, and she went away to Europe to get away from the press. 4 years later, something finally happened. A tabloid called the New York Daily Mirror, which was published by William Randolph Hearst, claimed there was new evidence in the case and that Frances Hall should be brought to justice. The newspaper reported a maid who worked for the Halls coming forward and saying Reverend Hall was planning on eloping with his Wonderheart, Eleanor Mills, and that his wife got wind of his plans and went after him, also claiming that she was paid $5,000 to keep quiet.
The maid was?
The maid.
Huh.
People were so outraged by the tabloid headlines that the governor reopened the case, and on January 28th of 1926, Frances was brought in on murder charges along with her 2 brothers, Henry Hugill Stevens, and Willie Carpenter. Not Carpenter, but Carpenter. Along with their cousin named Henry de la Bruyere, and a trial began for Francis Henry Hugill Stevens and Henry de la Bruyere. Carpenter, however, was allowed a separate trial. Don't know why, but they tried him separately. So it was hyped as the trial of the century, and with good reason. Not only had the crime been highly sensationalized in the media, but all four suspects were well off and very influential in the community. Francis was related to a lot of important people, such as the Johnson & Johnson people, supposedly, but that hasn't actually been proven. And her cousin was a Wall Street broker, so she had some clout. The trial began on November 3rd, 1926, and lasted for 23 days, giving reporters enough juicy content for weeks on end. There were even celebrities who came to watch the trial.
Really?
Yep. No one that you'd ever have heard of because it was the 20s and they weren't like actors and actresses that were in the silent films or anything at the time.
That's all I know from the 1920s.
Pretty much. The media at the time began calling Frances Hall the Iron Widow because she didn't seem to show any emotion in court, which further sensationalized
the
things.
The Iron Widow.
The Iron Widow, I know.
I just like pictured like a weird combination between like an old lady in like a Victorian gown and like Iron Man.
It sounds like a superhero. It kind of does.
Iron Widow.
Another weird name was given to the prosecution's eyewitness, Jane Gibson, who lived on the farm. They began calling her the Pig Lady because she raised pigs. I don't care if that's the reason for the name. I'd still be really pissed to be called the Pig Lady.
Yeah. You sound like some kind of creepy urban legend.
Yeah. Oh, have you seen the Pig Lady? Yeah. She's said to live on this farm.
Don't go there at night.
Yeah. So Jane, the Pig Lady, said that her dog began barking loudly around 9 p.m. on the night of the murder. So she went outside to check it out and saw a man standing in her field. She rode her mule toward the man, and when she got closer, she saw that there were four people by the crabapple tree. She then heard gunshots, and one of the people fell on the ground. After, she reported hearing a woman scream, "Don't," several times. At this point, she turns the mule back around and heads for her house, while she hears three more gunshots. She also said that she heard a woman shout the name Henry. To make everything more dramatic, Jane was dying of cancer at the time and was wheeled into the courtroom on a stretcher and accompanied by a doctor and two nurses and placed on an iron hospital bed facing the jury to testify.
Oh my God, no wonder people are so fascinated by this. It has like literally everything.
It has exactly. I mean, I don't want to say that I love a crime, but I kind of love this one. While I'm sure this added to the jury buying her story, it seemed like she was lying during her testimony, and even her own mother, who was in the gallery at the time, shouted, "She's a liar," repeatedly.
Wow.
Yeah. Her story had changed with every telling between the initial report to the police, what she told the newspapers, and then what she said at trial.
Okay. So it's like you have someone who's dying, and there's this media sensation around this murder trial, and she just kind of comes forward as like a star witness. It's not a bad way to go out.
That's true.
These people come to your funeral because you're the Pig Lady.
Because you're the Pig Lady. Exactly. You're famous. So, Henry Hugill Stevens even had an alibi for the time of the slayings, saying he was fishing at the time, and there were three witnesses to back up his claim. So the jury, of course, believed what he said. Things aren't looking so great for the prosecution at this point. And in the end, since Francis Hall was an upstanding citizen with no priors and was considered a pillar of the community, the jury sided with Hall's widow, and she and her brothers were acquitted. And directly after, she sued the Daily Mirror for $3 million. Because, you know, they needed even more money, being that rich. So the sum would be about $43.5 million today.
Dang.
Yep. And also, Henry Carpenter was never even tried for the crime, because he was the one that was going to be tried separately.
Mm-hmm.
They never even touched him. They didn't bother. So to this day, the murder goes unsolved, but there are several theories. Some people believe that by having the affair, Hall had violated the moral code, I didn't even know they had one, of the KKK, so they killed him. I couldn't find anything stating that he was even a member of the Klan, but according to a man named William Kunstler, the way they died was a trademark of the Klan.
Hmm. That's kind of weird, too, because the Klan in the 20s was kind of a different organization than the Klan you think of in, like,
true.
The, you know, late 1900s, so... Yeah. If he was a member, you should be able to find that information and verify it, because they kept very clear...
records, yeah.
Yeah, because they were essentially like an MLM at that point.
Pretty much. So some people think, myself among them, that it's more likely for the killer to be Eleanor's husband since she was taken out more violently. And not that I'd ever kill someone for cheating on me, but I, like I said before, I'd definitely be more mad at her. I couldn't find anything that's saying he was even ever a suspect in this case, which just seems like huge oversight by the police.
For sure. He should have been the second suspect after the husband, or after the wife.
Absolutely, yeah. But they never even looked into him at all from what I found. A lot of people believe that Frances, her brothers, and her cousins all got away with murder that day. And part of me thinks this isn't the case because of the weird pig lady and the fact that Henry Hugill Stevens had an alibi with witnesses. And then again, it's possible the witnesses could have been paid off. So who knows? Because they did have a lot of money. Whatever the case may be, the Hall Mills murder was certainly one crazy ride from start to finish. And unfortunately, too much time has passed now for them ever really to solve it. It's so we'll never know.
I know. And it's kind of weird when you think more about it. Like, so Hall basically had no money. It's all his wife's money. So the fact that he would, like, was planning to leave her for this other woman kind of doesn't track so well for me.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to leave you and be poor.
Weird.
And then...
But I mean, if you're in love with your darling Wonderheart, you do weird things.
Yeah. But I think the darling Wonderheart's husband did it.
I think so too. Just taking out babykins.
Taking out babykins. Well, that was a very exciting story.
I was so excited when I found it because I was like, this has literally everything in it. It was just, I mean, it's unfortunate they had to die, of course. Always. But it made for a really, really good story.
I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And I also have some news for you, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yes, I might be able to go on a ghost hunt in October.
Oh, that's super exciting. Where?
It's going to be Three Birds Coffee House.
Where is that?
That is downtown Easton.
Oh, I love downtown Easton.
And it's going to be fun because now I just learned that I'm also giving a ghost tour beforehand.
Also
in
town?
Which I've never done before.
Is it also in downtown Easton?
Yes.
Nice.
And I found out some really interesting, cool things I didn't know before, like the church that I used to go to with my mom is actually haunted, and it was built over a burial ground.
Whoopsie.
So that's always nice. But it should be a lot of fun.
I'm excited for you. I want to know what happens.
Absolutely. I'm definitely going to talk about it on the podcast after.
Excellent.
So if you guys want to know, don't worry. I got you covered. All right. I guess we should take a little break, and then we'll be back with some more stories from Nicole. And we're back. So, Nicole.
Yes?
Little Birdie told me that you have a story for us as well.
I do. So
not that that's like the point of the podcast or anything.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's a surprise. I have a story to tell you.
Wow, I'm shocked. Go for it.
So our stop today is in Alpine, New Jersey. It's a small borough in the northeastern part of the state. It's about 15 miles from Midtown Manhattan, so it's super close to New York City.
Okay. So again, another one in the New York City area.
Yep. So we're heading to the affluent Rio Vista neighborhood. It's actually one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the country.
Oh, wow.
And it's just full of, like, all of these huge homes, like, multiple million-dollar homes. And in the center of it, there is a tall clock tower that looms over all these palatial houses.
I don't know why, but the idea of clock towers in towns, it, first of all, kind of cool. Second of all, kind of creepy to me. I don't know why, but something about it is a little creepy.
Well, this is definitely not a creepy app.
Well, that's good. I think it was just because there's this game for PlayStation, like, years ago. That's probably, like, 95 or somewhere around there. That was called Clock Tower. And it was basically like being in a horror movie where you had no weapons, nothing to defend yourself with. You had to use, like, random objects that you found, or you had to hide and hope the killer didn't find you.
Yeah, it was a little high tension.
Yeah, so maybe that's why my clock tower thing is a thing.
Well, today's story isn't going to make you feel any better about clock towers.
Great.
So the clock tower, it's originally called Rionda's Tower, but locals know it by a much more sinister name, the Devil's Tower.
I think I have heard of this.
Oh, exciting. So the Devil's Tower is 100 foot tall. It's composed of these deep gray stones, and it has this overall neo-Gothic architecture.
Cool.
It has these, like, really narrow arrow slit-like windows. So basically this tower looks like a piece of a long-forgotten castle that someone just dropped into Jersey.
Oh, wow.
The tower was built in 1904 by a sugar baron named Manuel Rionda as part of his sprawling 200-acre estate, which was also called Rio Vista. Okay. So his huge estate eventually is the land that became this neighborhood, and that's why the neighborhood's called Rio Vista.
Oh, wow. Okay. So not rich at all.
No, not rich at all. So Rionda was a pretty interesting guy. He was actually born in Spain in 1854, and his family started investing in Cuban sugar plantations in the 1860s.
Okay.
As their plantations grew more and more successful, they ended up actually emigrating to Cuba in the 1870s. Rionda at the time was a teenager. He was about 16 when they left Spain, and he spent the rest of his youth running and managing these sugar plantations. Now, at this time in the 19th century, sugar is pretty much king in Cuba. It's their major cash crop. It is what drives the Cuban economy.
So not cigars.
So not cigars. Not yet. Sugar. And the Rionda family makes a fortune in sugar. Like, serious money. So much so that by the early 1900s, Rionda's company that his family started, that he now manages, sold almost 40% of all the sugar produced in Cuba.
Wow.
Yeah, so this guy is like, not just wealthy, he's like capital W wealthy.
I need to rethink all of my career choices.
And perhaps build a time machine.
Yes.
So eventually, Rionda decides to build his business empire a little bit wider and larger, and he launches a major New York sugar brokerage firm so he can sell more effectively the sugar that his plantations are producing in Cuba. This leads him to move to the United States, and he ends up building this huge estate across the river, the Hudson River, in Alpine, to live in. His wife, Harriet, who is a tried-and-true New Yorker, really missed living in the city while the couple was at the Rio Vista estate, so Rionda built the tower behind the main house for her. At 100 feet tall, she could basically go to the top of the tower and have this lovely scenic view of the Manhattan skyline, basically from her own backyard. So, pretty romantic gesture, if a bit, like, capital W wealth excessive.
Okay, yeah.
Now, here's where the story gets kind of creepy. You have this huge tower in the middle of Alpine, New Jersey, built by this super-duper wealthy guy. His wife dies of natural causes in 1922, and Rionda has a plaque dedicated to her memory added to the tower. Almost immediately, rumors start.
Great.
Yep.
Love a good rumor.
The locals began whispering about Harriet's death, saying that maybe it wasn't from natural causes and that her ghost is actually haunting the tower.
Ooh.
The local legend says that one evening, Harriet's climbing the tower to enjoy the evening sunset over Manhattan, like she often does. Once she's at the top, instead of looking out on the skyline, she actually spots Rionda in a romantic liaison with another woman.
Dun, ooh. Dun, dun.
So she's totally distraught and heartbroken, and she throws herself off the top of the tower. Later that evening, Rionda finds his wife's mangled body at the base of the tower.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So, shortly thereafter, visitors who come to the tower start to hear strange noises. They feel cold spots around the tower, and a lot of them have the feeling of being physically pushed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, by an unseen force. So that's super creepy. According to this legend, Rionda is convinced that his wife's vengeful spirit was tormenting him for his infidelity. So he has the tower sealed, and he puts up a plaque dedicated to her memory at the base of the tower where he finds her body, all in an attempt to, like, pacify her pissed-off spirit.
Great. I would do the same.
Rionda eventually dies. Now, according to other local rumors, several years after his death, the town of Alpine is building out this neighborhood over his old estate, and they decide they need to tear down this tower to build a new road through the neighborhood.
Okay.
So as construction gets underway, the town suddenly abandons its plans to destroy the tower after several workers follow their deaths. So instead, the town decides to not mess with the tower anymore, not endanger any more lives, and they actually build a road around the tower. So to this day, there's actually a road that runs through the Rio Vista neighborhood that goes around
the clock tower.
Local lore also says that you can summon Harriet's ghost by walking or driving backwards around the tower 3 times at midnight.
Okay, let's not drive backwards around the tower. Nope.
No challenge except that you can totally unlock that achievement.
Well, it actually reminds me of this meme that I saw earlier that, again, was like a fall basic bitch meme. That was, as you sit here drinking pumpkin spice.
I know, as I sip my pumpkin coffee.
And it said, if you say pumpkin spice latte 3 times in the mirror, a white girl in leggings and Ugg boots will come out and tell you everything she loves about fall.
Well, that's definitely not how Harriet's ghost is going to appear.
Damn, okay.
She's going to be more pissed off than that. Oh, and then the other cool thing, apparently also, because this tower is the devil's tower, if you walk or drive around backwards 6 times at midnight, you can summon the devil himself.
Oh, wow. So he and, what's the...
Harriet.
Yeah, just hanging out all the time at this tower?
Or... I guess. I mean, that's kind of a horrible
cosmic...
Only if
you drive backwards?
Can you imagine the horrible cosmic misty? You're like, I was trying to reach Harriet, not Satan.
I'm just trying to think of how many accidents that, like, people
well,
trying
it's
this.
It's midnight, so it's fine, right?
Yeah, you know what? I've still seen plenty of people out on the road at midnight,
all
so...
Right. Fair enough. So, and then this is something that a lot of local teenagers would do as, like, a test of, like, metal to, like, go out to the Devil's Tower and walk around it and blah, blah, blah.
We just did Bloody Mary, for God's sakes.
Well, I mean, New Jersey. It's the wealthiest neighborhood in the country. One of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the country. They got to challenge themselves.
So everyone's bored.
Yeah.
Because they have too much money.
One common paranormal experience, though, that people say they see at the tower is a shadowy figure in one of the windows at the top of the tower. And so according to people who've reported this, it's when you first get to the tower and you look up, you see the shadowy figure in one of the highest windows, and then it disappears. And the weird thing about that is that the tower is actually sealed, so you can't go into it any longer.
Oh.
So everyone assumes that it's some kind of ghostly apparition. It could be Harriet's ghost, something like that.
And now, this clock tower is still running, like...
I don't know if the clock still works. I couldn't find anything in my research, but it's still in the neighborhood. It's still, like, part of the cityscape. Well, I guess townscape, because it's a small town. Yeah. So that's the local legend. It's pretty great. It's weird. It's spooky. Has everything. Has the tragic death. The gateway to hell. Love it. In reality, however, Rhianda and Harriet had a very happy marriage by all accounts, and there wasn't any accounts of infidelity that I could find. And they actually both did pass away from natural causes that you can actually find in
and
local
verify,
records.
Yes. Yeah.
So Harriet passed away in 1922 and Rhianda died in 1943. But still, it's one hell of a legend, and I thought the story was amazing.
That is a really cool story. I mean, you know, too bad it's not true. So please don't go around and drive backwards 3 or 6 times.
Yeah, don't drive backwards at night.
Just don't drive backwards at all. I mean, except if you're reversing, then I understand. But
they put the headlights on the front of the car for a reason.
Exactly.
So that's my story. That's our stop for today in New Jersey.
I liked it. It was fun. I had a good time, and I hope you guys did too. We'd love to hear from you, so please email us with your stories or just to say hi even at roadsidehorrorshow@gmail.com.
You can follow us online at Twitter, Instagram, or on Facebook at Roadside Horror Show. And also a plug for our logo creator, which was designed by Yax Rocks Designs. Very cool. You'll see that on all of our social media properties. All right, everyone. We'll talk to you soon.
Yep. See you next week.